I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. We have an open office this morning. We have three new members. John Mars from Henderson, who will replace Sam Bateman. Welcome.
Thank you.
Wade Wagner.
Not here.
If he does come at some point, we could digress from our agenda. And Craig Hafen from Mesquite.
Alternates.
Alternate. Who is Mr. Lippman, who has been our, who has been here with us often. So we will now do our oath of office for Mr. Mars.
And before we do that, I just want to confirm that the meeting has been posted in accordance with the open meeting law.
Thank you. Do you want Mr. Mars to walk around, or can he just...
I do solemnly swear that I will support and protect and defend the Constitution and government of the United States and the Constitution of the government of the state of Nevada against all enemies, whether domestic or foreign, and that I will bear true faith, allegiance, and loyalty to the same, any ordinance, resolution, or law of any state notwithstanding, and that I will well and faithfully perform all the duties of the member of the Southern Nevada District Board of Health, on which I am about to enter, so help me God.
Thank you. Welcome to our board.
Thank you.
We'd also like to recognize the service of Councilman Bateman from Henderson, Pamela Goines Brown from North Las Vegas, and Carl Gustafson from Mesquite. And I don't believe we have any of the three, but we want to, we have some certificates and those will be sent to them in appreciation. So if you do see any of those who have been serving, if you could express gratitude, and we thank them for their time and service. We'll now move to our public comment period to speak on items on the agenda. Do we have anyone here who wishes to speak at this time? Seeing none, we'll move to adoption of the July 25th agenda. Do we have a motion or any discussion questions about the agenda?
I'll make a motion.
Have a motion?
Second.
We have a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Item number one is to receive a report from the nomination of officers for the Board of Health officers. And we, committee chair, Dr. Tarkanian, will give the pass the time to her.
The nomination of officers committee met on June 13th. And at that time, the committee recommendations, and you can see the people nominated in your minutes that are included within the packet that we have. The nominations were chairman and selected were chair Rod Woodbury, vice chair Bob Beers, secretary Lois Tarkanian, and I thank Mr. Jones, who also was nominated for secretary. He was very kind to say when I wanted a second term, he was very kind to step aside. So those are our nominations. Chair Rod Woodbury, Vice Chair Bob Beers, Secretary Lois Tarkanian. And would you take a vote on that, or do
yes.
I take a vote? You do.
Would you like to make a motion for that?
Oh, okay. I move that the slate of officers as recommended by the Nomination of Officers Committee on June 13th be approved.
Second.
We have a motion from Councilwoman Tarkanian, and who was the second?
Lippman.
Mr. Lippman. Councilman Lippman. Do we have any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It appears we have a unanimous vote. Congratulations, Mr. Woodbury. Would you like to continue the meeting?
The only thing I can figure is somebody saw me doing my crossword puzzle up here and thought I needed to pay better attention, so I will try to muddle through it with the help of those of you that have done this before, and I think Councilman Beers could probably give us all a lesson on procedure from the state.
Sometimes that's not the best way to go.
I think you have to have interested students first.
That's right. All right. So it looks like we're to the oath of office for those that were just inducted.
Down here.
I do solemnly swear that I will support, protect, and defend the Constitution and government of the United States and the Constitution of the government of the state of Nevada against all enemies, whether domestic or foreign, and that I will bear the true faith, allegiance, and loyalty to the same, any ordinance, resolution, or law, any state standing, and that I will well and faithfully perform all the duties of the office of the Southern Nevada Health District Board of Health, of which I am about to enter, so help me God.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item is the consent agenda, and I'll entertain a motion.
I'll move to accept.
Second.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Looks like passed unanimously in the affirmative. The next item is public hearing on the regular agenda. And do we have public comment first? Is that what we do?
There are no items to be heard in the public hearing items.
Okay. So we'll move forward to the closed session at this time. Do we need to take a motion to go to closed session?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Mr. Chair, you should actually read the closed section items okay. into the record.
All right. Closed session. We're going in closed session pursuant to NRS 241.015-2B2 to receive information from the Southern Nevada Health District's attorney regarding potential or existing litigation involving matters over which the board has supervision, control, jurisdiction, or advisory power, and to deliberate toward a decision on the matter.
Very good.
And this time we'd ask those that need to be cleared from the room, please take.
An opportunity for us to try to get that resolved. But I think that that's now been resolved, and we have that date and time set for July 30th. So we can, this is a moot issue.
Okay. We'll move on then.
Unless there's something else.
Well, perhaps at this time we could kind of identify the process to go through. The agenda was just posted, but I think it would be good to have the board be aware of that because we had to post that by yesterday. Would that be appropriate, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
What we thought to have the format, to have a few moments for discussion about that at the beginning of the meeting, but to have the candidates not present during the interview of the other candidate and to draw for them to go first and second at the beginning of the meeting, and then to have 40-minute period for each of the candidates, have a 5-minute opening statement, have a 20-minute with pre-written questions by the consultant, which we had done at the last meeting, which we had approved. And so everyone will receive those questions, and so if you could choose a question that you would like to ask, and then we'll kind of be organized at that, and there'll be a 20-minute period, and we'll time those answers for 3 minutes and get through up to 3 minutes. and so we could get through at least 7 questions and potentially more if the answers are shorter. Then there'd be a 10-minute redirect for questions, for new questions or questions that maybe were thought of during the previous session, and those would be not untimed period, so a 10-minute period, and then a 5-minute closing statement by the candidate. And then that would be repeated for the other candidate, and then would be the time for deliberation. So neither candidate would be in the room while the other candidate was being questioned, and those questions and the agenda will be sent to both candidates.
Do we intend to vote at that meeting, or?
It's on the agenda. So we would have that potential, but if it needs to be brought back, we would have that ability as well.
And I believe that agenda has been sent out to everyone. Okay, the special agenda has been posted.
And those questions will be coming as well. We have those. So that's, Mr. Jones was also part of that. He saw that arrangement and agreed with that, and so.
Are these the questions?
Yes.
Interview questions for the 2013 recruit?
Yes.
That's it.
Yes. So if everyone could be familiar with those, and at the beginning of that meeting then on the 30th, the proposal was to have everyone kind of find a question that you could identify with so we're prepared and able to ask those questions in the best way possible.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions about that?
Well, when you get down to 15 picks and we're on that 16th thing that nobody wants, I'll take that one.
You got it.
And they don't necessarily have to be in order.
All right, we will next move on to item number 7, board reports. And actually, probably now is a good time. I can start that out. I just wanted to, there wasn't an item on the agenda to thank the outgoing officers, but I think that's very appropriate at this time. And just wanted to commend Commissioner Scow and Councilman Bateman for their fine work during this past year as chair and vice chair. And I know Commissioner Scow in particular has a very, very busy schedule, and you know, it's a lot of work behind the scenes. It's not just showing up to these meetings and muddling through the agenda, but you know, she has to be there for everything that staff needs her for during the week, and through the legislative session. I thought we did a fantastic job this year, so thank you for that. And I've been advised as well by Annette that probably now is a good time to maybe not entertain a motion, but some kind of staff directive coming out of the closed session. So, Councilman Beers, did you want to?
Well, sure. I would. How do we do this other than in the form of a motion?
Well, you know, and after saying that, if we're going to have the meeting, then do we still want to get that information? Because a comment was made that that might add fuel to the fire. So do we just want to have the meeting and see what flows from that? If that meeting will help us resolve the issues that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'd like to see a timeline, like some 30 days or 60 days to set up a meeting. If there's not a meeting scheduled, then we proceed with the other alternative.
Well, I'm going to immediately reach out to the commissioners to start scheduling, finding out who they want to have at the meetings, and start getting that on the books so that we can get that scheduled immediately.
Does that require any board action?
No, I that's
just a direct
that's your direction. Okay.
So I'd like to have feedback at the next meeting, and if nothing is able to be scheduled, then I think we need to proceed with the second option, because as a taxpayer it's very frustrating mm-hmm. for me.
Understood.
Especially when we've probably spent between the county and the health district probably about $1 million or $100,000 or more for attorney's fees to try and resolve this, when there's other agencies that are bleeding right now and have needs.
And a Supreme Court directive.
Exactly. So I'd just like to not see it drawn way out, and I'd like both agencies to move forward in a positive way more rapidly.
Well, I will immediately open the dialogue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr.
I would like to see an accounting of what the Health Board has spent. I feel like, I think that would be something.
I can get that to you by tomorrow.
Okay.
Can that be distributed to all the board members?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
If I understand, excuse me.
Yes, go ahead.
If I understand, then what's going to happen is that you're going to reach out and see if you guys can't set up a meeting.
Yes, correct.
And by our next board meeting, you'll be able to tell us you were able to, you had the meeting, you didn't have the meeting, and what the content was and what might have happened.
Yes. Is
that the intent?
That's the intent.
Then I'd like to suggest that we don't further fuel the fire.
Okay.
Right.
That's my suggestion for a month.
Right.
If that's all right with everybody.
So I think you understand.
Okay.
Okay. Do we have any other board reports?
I have two quick items.
Yes.
First of all, I'd like to at least go on the record and thank Senator Dennis for his invaluable help saving all of us alternates. So we would not be here without him. Secondly, there's another issue I wanted to bring up, and we're going to have some guest speakers coming in about, well, 9:30 unless we adjourn this early. But almost 2 years ago, I had approached the solid waste management staff about there has become the ability to craft and apply for a recycling license that lets you process construction demolition debris just like a materials recovery facility without the health and safety issues that Title 30 requires. For the past year, the MRF operators have been trying to resolve this with staff, but so far we've not come to any kind of agreement. The MRF operators have approached me to bring this matter to the board's attention with the hopes of fostering some kind of dialogue to address these difference in health and safety issues when you have two diverse types of operations occurring. Towards in the public comment section at the end of the meeting, we're going to have either three or four of the local operators are going to be in here to speak to those issues that they have been trying to raise with solid waste and get resolved. So I appreciate your attention to that when they're here. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
What was the section that you referred to?
Section 10.
Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to item number 8, which is health officer and staff reports, and turn it over to Dr. Madaw.
Thanks very much. And before I start those reports, I'd just like to echo my commitment to try to improve communications, and I'll do everything I can in the next month to see how far in advance we can come together. I certainly want to thank Commissioner Scow, Chris G., and Commissioner Weekly, because they've had an open door. I think they are aware of the efforts we've tried to make to keep communications open. And in fact, Elaine and I will be meeting with Don Burnett on Monday morning. We scheduled that because we've had numerous meetings. In the last month, there have been a lot of things going on, so we missed one or two weeks in there. But that commitment is very deep in me, and I would love to see how far we can move this forward in the next month that I still have with the district. And I really appreciate the work you've done and the comments and the guidance that I've received from you about what's going on and how to make that process work.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, just a brief comment, please.
Yes, go ahead.
And I appreciate that, Dr. Madaw. And one of the things that council indicated, I'm sure Commissioner Scow and I'm going to make sure I relay this back to Commissioner G, because I'm not sure if anybody had an opportunity to read any of those comments into that's from the record that council spoke about. But if, in fact, that they are derogatory and it appears as though there's a lot of pushback and they're saying derogatory things about this board, I mean, that's totally unacceptable. And I think that's something that needs to be brought to the attention of the county manager, because I believe that everybody that's sitting here on this dais and in this room are here for the right reasons, trying to do the right thing. And so that's totally uncalled for, and I don't believe that you can get anywhere if, in fact, those are the type of conversations you guys are having. And I would think that this board here would say, too, that none of us up here would condone any of that foolishness, because it's a bunch of waste, it's a waste of time, and it's a waste of taxpayer dollars, and we want to see these wheels turning and get this thing resolved. So thank you very much, and we'll do our part to make sure that we try and help move this process forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Well, for my reports now, I thought that I would share with you just a little bit about wood smoke. I mean, it's a little after the fact right now, thank goodness, but we were having all these advisories, and I have to say, about a week ago Thursday, on my way home, it looked to me like the apocalypse was happening. I mean, the sun was behind the mountains, the smoke was billowing, and I could see the flames on the ridge as I drove up the Summerlin Highway, and it was just staggering. Well, when I was in Alaska, one year we had 1 million acres burn, and the wood smoke was going all the way down to Vancouver and Seattle, 1,500 miles, and we had weeks where in the city of Fairbanks you couldn't see a block. And so we did extensive epidemiologic surveillance and studies trying to look at the impacts on human health from exposure to the wood smoke. And of course there's been huge wildfires in Colorado and in Florida and North Carolina and in California. So there's a tremendous amount known about what happens when we are subjected to the smoke from these fires. And of course we have standards from EPA and the air quality people were issuing advisories and warnings, but I just wanted to put some of this in perspective, because happily, while it's not intuitively obvious, very few serious health effects occur to people who are exposed to wood smoke. And part of it's because we're smart, and when it's, you know, really acrid out there, we don't go outside. We go to the mall or go inside with air conditioning and where there's air filters. But in fact, can we put those pictures on? I thought I'd give you a few snapshots, and they talk about good visibility being 11 miles and higher. And what's measured are particulates in the air, and there's just constant terminology. And what it really is, you hear PM, which is particulate matter, and then you hear a number, PM10s or PM2.5s. Well, that's 10 microns, and PM2.5s are 2.5 microns, which is, you know, like maybe 15 times less than the diameter of your hair. And PM2.5s is the size of a crystal of sulfur dioxide in the air. And if you inhale those tiny particles, they go into the alveolus of your lung, the deepest recesses of the lung. And of course, it's moist there. So if you get sulfur dioxide deposited deep in the lung and there's water there, that forms sulfuric acid. And that's why the whole national strategy used to be control PM10s. And that was because that's all we could measure. And what we've learned is that particles of 10 microns and higher are generally trapped by your nose, your nasal pharynx, deposited in your trachea, and they don't get down into the alveolus, the deepest one cell thick area where the oxygen exchange occurs between the air and transferring oxygen into the blood and getting CO removed. And so what's happened is, with better technology, there's monitoring now accurately for PM2.5s, and those are the ones that are of most concern for public health. But on this slide above, this is the city of Fairbanks, and there's two of them that I have here to show you, and that's the one during the fire. And could you do the other one? And that's on a clear day. Now, on a clear day in Fairbanks, the particulates are 10. I mean, it's very, very clean air there. And on the slide, go back to the first one, the from Fairbanks, that one. On that one, that's 900 micrograms. 900 particles per cubic meter of air. And you could see that kind of smoke, which hardly allows you to see a light a block away, hung over the city of Fairbanks for a week. And we monitored ER visits, coronary care admissions, asthma attacks, and everything, and we didn't find any change. It was just amazing. So I just, and then if we can go through the next slide. So here's South Carolina fire. Go ahead. And here's one from North Carolina in a peat bog. These are fire pictures from here, from the Carpenter One fire from Walmart next, and just amazing the amount of smoke and particulates that come from this. But our bodies are designed, for whatever reason, to keep us pretty much from getting catastrophically ill when we're exposed to these kinds of events. So I thought I'd just share that with you. It's when you look at some of the warnings that came out, they're pretty dire, and they can tend to cause a lot of concern and panic. But fortunately, the actual adverse health consequences related to serious health events are very minimal and far less than you would think, based just on sort of common sense, looking at how bad that thing looks. I thought I'd then go and talk to you just a little bit about transition. Been working pretty hard with the staff here to identify major things to try to accomplish or to deal with in the next month. And so what we've been doing is we've been doing some strategic planning regarding informatics and epidemiology. We had a very productive meeting yesterday talking about how we're going to be developing our databases, how we're going to have our informatics skills merge with our epidemiology skills, but made available to the whole district. So to environmental health, to all of our nursing programs, and actually to finance and administration. We have a leadership team scheduled for a whole day on the 13th. And the purpose of that is really for us to try to envision where do we see the district going in the next 5 years and 10 years. What are the major issues and challenges that we anticipate? And one of those is going to be, what's the future of public health under the Affordable Care Act? And it's a great concern. It's only the role of public health is only now starting to be really talked about nationally, and it's fortunate that the dialogue is occurring, albeit very late in the game. And what I'm talking about is that when the full effect of the Affordable Care Act occurs, hundreds of thousands of people are going to all of a sudden have health care coverage in order to provide clinical preventive services. Well, we don't have a system today that enables access to those services for the people who are currently entitled through Medicaid and other insurance. And so when we add this coverage, it's going to really cause a problem where people are simply not going to have providers to provide these services. Now, public health, as we've talked about before, has a very unique role in protecting the population. And I think I've shared with you in the past the issue of, you know, when someone has severe tuberculosis and they have massive clinical needs, we don't do that. I don't go down and have rounds at the UMC intensive care unit to take care of somebody's complicated medical needs, which include all the side effects of the drugs and the other problems they have. We're there to find out where they got TB and who they infected, and try to find those people, and if they need medication, make sure they're on it, and then monitor that they take those medications until they become non-infectious and can't transmit the disease further. Well, most public health agencies got out of the primary health care business 20 and 30 years ago. So around the country, you have whole states that don't do any clinical preventive care and case management. And so now what's happened is that there are many on the federal level who are saying, gosh, we're not going to need to provide funding to local health departments in the future for things like immunization or STD or HIV or HIV treatment, or for many of the other core programs, or for surveillance, because, gee, they'll just bill. And people have said, okay, if you're a public health agency, get with the program. Go set up billing for private insurance, because then you're going to be able to get money that you bill for service, and you're not going to need any of these federal program dollars anymore. And I can tell you that's completely wrong. And when we're out doing an investigation, often there is no one to bill, and there's massive services that can only be supported with tax dollars. So as this debate occurs in the future, you're going to hear a lot more about it, because I'm going to call on all of you to be advocates to maintain the core funding for public health that cannot be provided or acquired by us billing people for our services.
Okay. So this is a discussion we've been having in the outpatient clinics at UMC, and I've kind of spearheaded it, and we're trying to form a committee to have the discussions of the Affordable Health Care Act and the impact on the outpatient clinics, because they're going to broaden Medicaid, so patients will have the ability to go to any provider, and it will be an open market, and there's four levels of plans they can select to enroll in. So I've been talking with the staff about looking at incorporating or increasing the preventive care piece, and not just primary or secondary. That's more intense when people already are diagnosed with diseases, but adding that piece in, and I've been encouraging them to sit down and talk with the health district about how we can unite services rather than try and duplicate services, which has kind of been happening indirectly, and in some ways we've already been buddying. So I would like to really encourage further dialogues and incorporating some of the other county public agencies into those discussions about how to blend services to accommodate the Affordable Health Care Act.
I agree with that totally, and I just am trying to say that our leadership team is going to seriously try to address these issues, mm-hmm. and this will be an ongoing dialogue for several years, but mm-hmm. the big concern for public health is that I can tell you that there's no way we can run a public health agency without tax dollars and income for the core programs, regardless of what services we end up billing for.
Right.
Now, other things that I'm trying to undertake here in the next month include a complete review of our vector control program. We had an issue about unfunded mandates at the schools, and they were going to drop the statutory requirement for measuring heights and weights in school children. And Superintendent Skorkowski, thank you, made a commitment that regardless of the future of the statutes, that he was willing to execute an MOU between the district and the school district to continue to collect those data for Southern Nevada and to work to expand the collections until finally we have the resources and ability to measure every kid in every school every year. And those data are very, very important for us and for the community in monitoring chronic disease. I'm going to make hemoglobin A1C and lipid measurements reportable through our electronic laboratory surveillance system, so we can enhance surveillance for chronic disease. And we could never have done this had we not had the benefit of Dr. Kreisman and our informatics team develop our whole new surveillance system, which includes electronic lab reporting. We're going to be finalizing the detailed fiscal analysis or budget to establish an indirect rate and to be able to provide very accurate information on the true costs of all the different mm-hmm. programs. Hopefully we'll be able to complete recruitment of the new Director of Environmental Health and Human Resources. We've done a recent analysis of mortality data looking at prescription drug poisoning. And it turns out that this is a massive epidemic in Las Vegas. We probably have the worst problems here of any place in the country. And in the last 10 years, the Centers for Disease Control has issued successive reports about what's happening nationally. But our rate of prescription drug unintentional deaths is almost twice the national rate. And of concern is that in the past, this was primarily a problem of males. Well, women are catching up, and so we've had a 74% increase in fatalities, and about 65% of all of these are narcotic prescription drugs. And so we just put a newsletter out to the Clark County Medical Society, trying to call in the Medical Society, work with the State Medical Association and the Nevada Medical Board of medical examiners to really seriously look at what we can do about this completely preventable problem. But currently, we have more deaths from prescription drug poisoning than we have deaths from firearms or from motor vehicles. It's the leading cause of injury deaths in our community. And so hopefully we'll be able to tackle this in the future. We've just had a very tragic death of a young woman who is 25 years old, and she became ill in February. She was in a fertility clinic and was successful in becoming pregnant, but she got very sick, had premature delivery of twins, one of whom died. Her health continued to deteriorate, and she unfortunately died in June. And at autopsy was found to have disseminated tuberculosis. And no one had made the diagnosis at any time during the period of her illness. And so we're engaged in a major investigation of trying to find out where she acquired TB, did she infect people, how infectious was she, and that involves, for example, testing all of the nurses in the neonatal intensive care unit, all the people who provided her care during her terminal illness, all of her family members. So we've been working with the state. We've gotten great support along with the hospitals and the medical people that we're working with, and we have resources we can call upon if need be from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to send additional staff out if we have to expand the circle of testing. And one of the concerns that's central is whether or not she was really infectious when she was visiting her newborns in the neonatal intensive care unit, and whether they might have exposed any of the other infants in that unit. It's very difficult to diagnose tuberculosis in kids less than two, much less in preemies, and medication to prevent infection has serious side effects if given to newborns and premature babies. So it's a very serious clinical decision as to whether or not to start these infants on any medication, and our hope is that we'll get very good information about the level of infectivity that she may have had at the during the period of time of her illness. But that's been a major focus for the last week for our TB and nursing staff and
at
epidemiology
UMC,
staff.
Dr. Middell?
Pardon me?
At UMC?
No. We're working very hard, and Elaine has taken a lead in trying to update our building options so that we can bring back, hopefully by the next meeting, some detailed information that would compare the size, downsizing a realistic footprint, and then costing out options for building at 625 Shadow Lane, or what might be an option regarding this facility here. We've also undertaken a comprehensive review of all Southern Nevada Health District policies, of which we found out we had more than 500, some dating back to 1960. So we're killing as many as we can, and we're focusing on the really important ones, and we will be continuing to update all of those along with an ability to bring them to you for final approval when we have them well-baked and understood, and then a mechanism to have them posted and available to all staff. Our EH group has created a working group to update and review all of the pool regulations that which we've talked about in the past, and that's under review. And we've also had are undertaking a detailed review of all of the program management plans for the next fiscal year. And I hope to complete that in the next month. And finally, our IT staff have developed an electronic timekeeping system. It's in the final deployment last test to shake it out. And then over the next several months, we'll be deploying that for the whole district. And it's going to eliminate tons of paperwork and enable us to have much more accurate information. So I just wanted to share those things with you and let you know that we're trying to work very hard to see if we can identify the most important transition items and then get closure on as many as possible, but put into place a process and a mechanism to see them to completion if it takes longer than the end of next month. And then finally, I prepared a progress report, and I had shared one with you at the board last December for my first 6 months, and rather than go through it, what I'll do is I'll send it out to all of you and be happy to talk to you about any part of it at the next board meeting. But I wanted to, again, just take a moment and thank all of you for the tremendous support that you've given me and the district during this last year It's, as you know, been a very challenging time, and I also want to thank all the staff at the district who have really pulled together and gone through a complete translocation from 625, and we have been making so many changes in many of the different programs, in some cases to get rid of programs that shouldn't have been there or were ineffective, to adopt new technology and policies, and to really roto-root the internal workings of how we do budgeting and payroll and federal grants and timekeeping and certifications. And all of these will continue to be worked on as a priority over the next year until we really have this place running like a Singer sewing machine. But again, thank you very much for all the support.
Thank you.
Rob.
The one right here first. Commissioner Scow.
Thank you. I just wanted to go back. I had a just a question. I know, Dr. Madal, we had talked about the rent on this building. If you could just make sure that we keep abreast of any ability to renegotiate.
Absolutely.
So that the board's always aware of what that situation is, with, because that's a very important cog in this whole wheel.
I agree, and I'm hoping that we'll have a report on the status of both the Valley View and the options for the building at the next board meeting.
Excellent. And I just want to say personally how much I appreciate your leadership in this last year. I feel that you've done a great deal to extend communication to all of us, and have just done a wonderful job in being proactive.
Thank you.
And cleaning up a lot of things that needed to be cleaned up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I too wanted to thank you for the wonderful job you've done. I've only been on the board a year, but I've been affiliated with the health district in the past and actually worked with Dr. Ravenhold in the past when I was setting up a student health center at UNLV. And the changes that you've implemented in the past year have been phenomenal. You're proactive. You have been a wonderful agent of change for win-win solutions, and moved us, or our health district, into more of the national standards, and it's truly appreciated with some of the things that we were seeing here. I can remember when I first moved here in 88, we didn't have a biohazardous law, and the health district couldn't comply, so they delayed changing the laws at the state until the health district could comply with disposing syringes out of the regular trash and into a biohazardous waste system. You've just done a tremendous job. I would like to comment on the prescription narcotic medications, and my personal experience in a county agency is that there's definitely a lot of neglect and a lot of patients that are over-medicated or mis-medicated. We have people that are non-pain management specialists, family practice practitioners, not just physicians, that are prescribing cocktails that could be lethal to patients, and I see it every day in my practice. It's a huge concern, and I would like to see that issue pursued in our state. I'd like to see people that are not pain management certified nationally go through some kind of special training and have a more accountable approach. I also would like to hear more about the medical marijuana clinics that are occurring, because I see a lot of people that are getting medical marijuana that come into our clinic and would like to see it prescribed, which is, we have a policy that we don't do that. So I'd like to hear more about that too, because if people are doing that separately and mixing it with their other cocktails of narcotic medication, it's just really not a good environment, a health conscious environment in our state, and we need to really address that.
Yes, just a question perhaps for Dr. Madar, almost anybody else. I thought we had a huge interactive database for patients and contraindications for medication. Is that not true?
I have to tell you that I don't know the answer to that, and the good news is that It took 5 years to build an infrastructure of epidemiology so we could do some of these analyses, and I'm very happy to accept credit for anything good that comes out of the district.
That's good.
And then have a whole list of people that I can blame if anything bad happens. But in this instance, our whole epidemiology team and informatics team have developed the capabilities now to do some of these analyses, which we simply couldn't do 5 years ago. And our epidemiologist, Jing Feng, was able to, who's a genius SAS programmer, was able to pull together a comprehensive evaluation of causes of death from chronic diseases. So I just said, hey, look, you've done all that work. Could you tackle the prescription drug issues? And she was able to turn this out in a couple of weeks. And so we're at the threshold of being able to go down into the data and get evidence-based information, not only on this problem, but on virtually almost all the problems of concern to public health. And that's, we're going to be at a renaissance for the next couple of years of being able to produce reports to all of you and to the community that will help us focus our energies and deal with the complexity of not only what's the problem, but then from that, how do we target the interventions? These are, a lot of them are very complicated, obviously multifaceted things which have happened, and what we can do is mobilize the appropriate stakeholders and experts to come back and say, okay, given this problem, now what are the array and menu of interventions that we can all agree that can make a difference in it?
The other thing is the Affordable Health Care Act has money available, funding for research, and they encourage research and looking at behavioral types of studies to change behavior for prevention and good health, and that might be something you want to think about looking at in trying to address some of these public health issues as prevention rather than intervention.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Councilman Tarkanian.
You know, as you're talking about the prevention side of it, I think often we don't realize how often people are exchanging medicines and how they don't want to get rid of them and they'll use them after someone passes away. My next-door neighbor had a son who injured his knee and was in extreme pain, and a friend came over, and the helpful friend said, well, I've got something in my car, you know, my uncle had used it, and then anyway, he let the young man use it, and he died, because this was someone who was on a cancer-oriented prescription type of thing, not realizing how strong this was. And on another incident very similar to that came up, and I'm thinking, if I'm finding out about two incidents like that, there's a lot more out there. And I think that preventative is extremely important. I don't think people realize how critical it is not to mix your drugs, not to say, oh, well it's a painkiller, I can take this painkiller. And maybe, I don't know how much we're doing with that, but that might be something, as you mentioned, we might focus on.
Yes.
Thank you. And one thing to add to what you have said is that when they discover these overage of unused prescription drugs, one of the things that people do is flush them down the toilet. And it turns out that even our tertiary membranes under the Clean Water Act for our wastewater cannot capture these incredible, some of them are very high molecular weight, but all these incredible mixtures of drugs, they go right into Lake Mead, such that when we take the water out to pre-process it for the Safe Drinking Water Act, okay, we can't capture everything, and the smaller hormones, you know, get through.
Right, and if I just might add, Councilman Beers and I
was just going to bring
say
that up.
On Saturday, Rainbow Park, what are the hours?
It's a Buffalo and Charleston. It's actually closer to Buffalo and Oakey. It's 8:30 to, no, I'm sorry, it's earlier than that. 7:30 to 9:30, I believe.
Well, in any case,
drive by, bring your prescription drugs.
We're offering a place for the prescription drugs because you don't want to throw them in the trash. You don't want to put them down the commode or the sink. And people know how toxic they are. And but then they say, well, what the heck am I going to do with them, you know? So we're trying to offer as much as possible. So if you know anybody or if you can get out the word, Saturday at Rainbow Park, which is Buffalo and Oakey.
And in fact, Metro has four substations that will also take the prescription drugs. So we need to get that word out, but I don't know how.
Yeah.
We're doing it.
Oh, you're doing it.
You're doing it right now, saying what you're saying, where you're saying it.
So I would like to add to that, that in our clinic, the pharmacists have actually seen patients selling narcotic pain medication to other patients. Therefore, we have very strict policies now because it's a good source of rent and they go for a high price on the street. We do random drug screens, and if they're negative and they're receiving narcotics, their medication is cut off. So there's a lot of reasons people seek narcotic pain medication. They do share with friends, they sell them to friends, or they over-medicate. People aren't being screened for the difference between addiction issues versus true pain, and I don't think a lot of the providers have that type of understanding or training when they are prescribing. And then when you do stop them, there's withdrawal issues, and we don't have good collaboration with all the agencies and resources in the community about going through detox programs for patients to get them to less higher risk medications to treat their chronic pain or their addiction.
Thank you. Mr. Devine.
Yeah, just on a little personal note about disposing of medications, I recently tried to dispose of some in the proper manner. It is very difficult in Clark County to do that. It took me several phone calls to just find a place that would do it that was a reasonable drive from where I lived. Is this something that the health district could actually look at where we can provide facilities? I mean, we have offices all over the valley where we can provide a collection.
Well, yeah, we can look into it, sure.
Be careful.
Mr. Devine, all your friends are recyclers.
You don't know what you're getting into.
Right.
You need to be careful.
Yeah, there's a real chain of custody problem there.
And robberies and all kinds of stuff.
And also, you might, as you do this type of educational work, I want to tell you the senior citizen homes are often a place where the drug trade is going well.
Yeah.
Because the senior citizens get the medicine and others come in and offer them a lot of money. I didn't realize we had that illegal trade going on until about 2 years ago.
That's crazy, senior citizens.
Yes.
Just a comment, I don't know if you can hear me. I'm licensed in three states for years and years and years and years, decades, longer than I like to think. California, New Mexico, and Nevada. All three state board of medical examiners and the licensing requirements over the last 5 years have been aware of everything you guys are talking about, and they are just as dumbfounded as to what to do about it. I know that all three states have required what the Board of Medical Examiners are allowed to do, which is require us to take more continuing education. And I'm inundated with requirements now to take continuing education related to pain medicine management, drug disposal, and all of that stuff, just to let you know that there are other agencies that are facing the exact same thing. And I don't know how what the legal jurisdiction is for the health department versus the oversight of the medical examiner's board or the PA board, you know, whatever it is. But this is a problem that is well known at least in the Southwest.
Yesterday I just
had a dinner with a fellow who's on the board of the Maricopa County Health District, and he brought up the exact same subject that we've just spent the last 3 minutes talking about in Maricopa County, and they're under the impression that they're the worst in the United States.
Mr. Nuna?
But on a completely different subject, I want to congratulate the board and the staff. Those of you that haven't had the opportunity to visit or see the new Bob Forbes LGBT Center down at about 400 Maryland Parkway, it's quite a facility. Our industry and our company, and specifically, was very instrumental in helping to fund that new phenomenal center. We had the chance to go down there and tour it the other day, and they were so complimentary of what the district does and the services they provide at that center. They couldn't be more pleased with the relationship that's been generated between the two entities, and said without it, there would be a lot more problems in our community than we see today. So I wanted to pass that along just as a side comment. As just someone touring their new facility, that was the comment they made about the board in the district.
Thank you.
Any more questions or comments related to CHO or staff reports? Okay, seeing none, you have the informational items before you, and we'll move to our last item, item number 10, which is public comment. Does anyone desire to speak?
Good morning.
Morning.
I guess I should identify myself, or how do you guys?
Please, yes.
Scott C. Strand with Discount Dumpsters. Our address is 2745 North Nellis. I wanted to bring up, and I'm not sure if staff's here or not. I don't see anybody from the Waste Division here, but I wanted to comment about some things that we're having a discussion about with staff. And the first piece of this, I want to compliment staff, even though they're not here, because from my own personal experience, they have always listened to me. They've always taken in our comments. I think they're working on some troubling things. They're trying to define some differences. We're dealing with new challenging areas that have to do with recycling. And to give you a little more background from us is that I operate a material recovery facility which has a component of recycling in it. And one of the challenges that we're facing is the definition distinction between a material recovery facility and a recycler or a recycling center. And I believe the intent of staff is to increase recycling, and I believe that they're trying to look out for the small business, and yet it's a little troubling to us that are in the MRF category, and we wanted to share some input that may be utilized as we go forward trying to determine what's the best solutions in making the right definitions. First off, I would suggest, and I feel that recyclers or recycling centers should not be permitted to receive what they call C&D or construction demolition waste, and should only be able to accept separated recyclables. And here's simply the reason. If you don't know what C&D is, it's construction and demolition waste. It's heavy, it's large, it is cumbersome, it's dusty, and it's difficult to manage and to process. Now, that's the reason material recovery facilities have been built, because they handle the safety and health concerns of trying to manage this material. The other issue with the recyclers is that they are required to recycle 90% of whatever they bring into their facility. And my personal experience is that handling C&D, which is what we handle, is that it's, in my opinion, impossible to economically recycle 90% of C&D. And so this by itself becomes a difficult challenge for any recycling center if, in fact, they're permitted to receive C&D. And they're simply, I don't think we're doing any favors to the regulators or to the permittee by authorizing as part of their permit to bring in C&D. Additionally, recycling in general requires space, and in using that space, if you have too small of a facility, the more you have to recycle percentage-wise, the more space you need. And so I think we're kind of in our efforts to help the recycler out, allowing them to bring C&D into their facility that are smaller, that don't have buildings and don't have the safety concerns. From our perspective, we think it's a difficult thing to do, and it puts too much of a burden on both staff, the regulators, who I believe are trying to do the right thing, but we believe it could be managed better by what type of material come in. So what would I recommend? My recommendation, which I've shared with staff, and I believe they're doing a few pilot programs on this, would be for a recycler to allow any material to come off a construction or demolition site, which we would normally call C&D, but it needed to be segregated and specifically recyclable material. If you were to take just truckloads of material from this building torn down and stick it in a container and take it to a recycler and ask them to recycle 90%, I believe that's a failure from the beginning. And so if they want to help a recycler and they want to allow them to compete for recycling, that I believe that their facilities are designed for the ability to on-site segregate those things that are actually commodities that they can actually sell, and they have less processing, and therefore there are less risks to the community. And in reference to what, if they want to do the larger, heavier processing, then they ought to be a MRF, not a recycling center. And so I don't know if you have any questions. And these, and secondly and last, again, I just thank the board for listening to that, and again to staff for their trying to figure out exactly how to do it. But I believe that's, in my opinion, the best recommendation on how to keep them in business, support them, the small business, not put additional risk on the community by having them able to bring in things that won't be able to be met by their obligation, and at the same time allow those that have invested into MRFs their specific part of the market. And I don't know if you have any questions, or I'll turn time over to anybody else.
Well, we all have one question here.
Go ahead.
Okay. What's, we all want to know what MRF is.
A MRF is not a cartoon.
Okay.
I say that as a joke because a lot of people call them Smurfs, but a material recovery facility.
Okay.
And they're designed to bring in the county codes require size of acreage, air control quality for the ground, buildings,
air suppression,
dust suppression, on and on and on, in order to make sure that this type of processing, so that instead of everything coming off of a construction site, that it will go to a material recovery facility where, in fact, those things that are recyclable can be taken out and diverted. And it's not just strictly taken directly to the landfill. And so I think there's a great, great positive thing occurring, you know, with the use of material recovery facilities or MRFs. And yet I know that it's a difficult process. It's not easy to do. And I can't imagine trying to recycle 90%.
Well, we're also looking at the number of N95 respirators you'd have to be wearing with all your staff for asbestosis, et cetera,
well,
and all the other
fact,
stuff.
And frankly, asbestos are not typically permitted to come to a MRF. So in that case, we're able to be protected from that. But everything else, I mean, it's a difficult process and requires certain things.
Do you also accept chemicals from construction sites?
We try not to, because we're not permitted to take them at the material recovery facility.
Just a couple of comments for clarification. A recycling facility has to have 90% recycled material at the point of pickup, not once they get to their site. In the material recovery business, they recover about 35% recycled material out of everything they bring in. And we all, you know, I know people there find it kind of strange how we get to 90% from 35%. As far as the hazardous materials, MRFs are not allowed to take anything hazardous at all. That still has to go through Republic Services and their area out there, and that includes asbestos.
Okay, thank you.
No further questions. I'll let any other comments that want to be made.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Cam Bryan. I'm here representing Part 3. We're located at 4610 Wynn Road. We also run a materials recovery facility. I would echo most of Scott's, if not all of Scott Seastrand's statements as to the staff's ability and willingness to work with all of us in the industry. The problem that I've seen, and I sat on this board as a member, as an alternate member of the past few years, and saw a huge increase in the number of recycling permits that were both applied and approved through the health district. And in the vast majority of those cases, it was working. It was recyclers that came in with a plan to say, we're going to be a metal buyback center, we're going to be a cardboard recycler, we're going to be a paper recycler. And those are what I believe the definitions fit the definitions perfectly. Those are the perfect uses for a recycler, because they're taking a specific type of material, they're bringing it back to their site before it ever gets to their site, it's been segregated. It's been, you might have a little bit of contamination in it, but it's 90%+ recycled before it ever gets there, and those are the perfect uses. What's starting to happen, and the reason that I feel like we need to comment today, is that there's the definitions between a MRF and a recycler are so similar that now recycling permits can go in and say, hey, we can do everything that a MRF does if we can meet this 90% standard. Well, the 90% standard by the health district's own admission cannot be regulated. They just don't have the resources to go out and say, hey, are you recycling 90%? And it's far too easy for a recycler to get in there and say, to kind of make it look like they're recycling 90% when everybody knows that if you take, like Scott says, this building and tear it down and take it over, there's no way you're going to recycle 90% of that. So the distinction is not significant enough to prevent a recycler from going to this board or this office and saying, hey, I want to be a recycler, I'm going to take C&D waste, and they're going to do everything a MRF does without the protections of a MRF. And what I always like to say is, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If a MRF has to have all of these environmental protections in place for the soil, for the air, for the stormwater, for everything else, why should a recycler be able to avoid those just by applying under a different permit? And that's the loophole I think that we need to close.
Ooh.
Comments?
I have one. So does Commissioner.
Councilman Beers?
No, I'll defer to.
No, go ahead. I'll wait to you.
Well, I guess my question is that a legislative issue?
Yeah, I think it's a health district definition issue. And when I've come in with Mr. Seastrand and we've met with the health district and proposed some changes to the language just in permitting. I don't think it needs to go all the way up to the legislature. I think it can be handled within the health district. This is the permitting authority.
Commissioner Weekly?
Have there ever been any type of, I would say, an impact type study to bring different entities together to close those loopholes? Because you have knowledge on your end because you're in the industry, but then you have lawmakers who are moved by their constituencies or special interest groups or what have you that impact their decisions. Have you all ever come together to kind of talk about that?
We have, and I think there's a little bit of conflict of interest there, because everybody wants to promote recycling, so it's hard, sure, to try and have a chilling effect by saying, hey, we don't want recycling, we want to make it more difficult. In fact, we want to make it easier. We just want to make sure the environmental protections are in place. And the great thing is that these are mutually beneficial regulations. The more that the materials recovery facilities take in, the more that the recyclers receive. We send our stuff to the recyclers. We just need to protect the environment and the process.
Well, I'm just following up, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair. Some people recycle because, again, they say they recycle because it sounds good. It's a good conversation piece, but a lot don't really understand the ins and outs of it. But let me ask you this, part three. You all are the company that you have a recycling center or a MRF located near Southern Highlands?
No, ours is located right off of Tropicana and I-15, kind of right in the heart of town.
Thank you.
Mr. Dubai?
Yeah, just one thing. Councilman Beers is right. There is a slight regulatory issue with the NRSs. They allow some of this type of material, but where this board can impact, this board has the ability to modify the quantities that a recycler can take in. Right now, a MRF can take in some 3,000 cubic yards of material, and the recycling centers have the same ability to do that. That's a lot of material. They'll fill up a football field. We have the ability here to reduce the amount that a recycling center can take without impacting their operations, because as Cam said, a lot of that material, once it's recycled, goes right to their facilities for them to make money.
Thank you. Yes.
Just another comment here. You had made an allusion to the fact that some of these people might not be following the Stormwater Pollution Prevention Act, Clean Water Act, etc. Have we ever looked at the possibility of doing an audit with those people? Because there's four federal laws that they might be escaping.
Well, the regulations with the recycling centers don't even require those sorts of prevention-type mechanisms in place. So you don't have, a recycling center, I can, if I wanted to come in and apply for a recycling permit, I could take a dirt parcel and I could go take a bunch of construction demolition waste and dump it on it and recycle it. You can't do that as a MRF. You have to have a concrete pad, you have to have a building,
right.
You have to have fire suppression, dust suppression, everything else. Well, the recyclers can do the exact same thing that the MRFs can do without any of the regulations. And so as to the question of whether or not there's an audit, certainly somebody could go out and test the soil and test, have the Department of Air Quality go over there and take a look. Mm-hmm. But, we in the industry certainly, aren't policing right. one another to the extent that we're saying, hey,
You just made an allusion to it was all, and that was my question, yeah. is anybody overseeing those guys?
With the limited resources that the health district has, I think they're out, spot checking where they can.
Okay.
In fact, that was one of the comments I'm going to make. Solid waste management is tremendously understaffed in inspectors nowadays. That's been a real problem that I've been hearing for well over a year from them. There's just not as many inspectors as they need to do the job. And that would be one thing if we're going to take on something like this that we really need to look at. Dennis Campbell has told me more than once that, this 90% is almost impossible for them to enforce because they have really no ability to look at material at the point of pickup.
Well, I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we have anyone else wishing to speak?
Good morning, Board. My name is Roberto Madrigal. I'm with Luna's Construction Cleanup. I also own a MRF here in Las Vegas. We've been here since 1988, and we were actually the ones that dumped trash on the ground and used to recycle it. About 8 years ago, we decided we're going to become a MRF and put up a building. And I can tell you from our experience that we have increased our recycling by 100% from moving to the model of dumping the material on the ground and recycling it to now putting it inside the building where there's conveyor belts and magnets. And we've also doubled our staff as well. So we've increased recycling, increased our staff, and it's a very clean environment. Like everybody has said, inside of a building, we can work at all hours. We have lighting. We are protected from the rain, from the wind, and everything stays nice and neat inside that building. So I agree with Scott Seastrand's comment earlier as far as recyclers really should not be permitted to bring in commingled C&D waste. That type of material really should be for material recovery facilities like the one that we've all have. And the market's open. I think from what we've, some studies that we've done, I think there's over 1.5 million, is that pounds, right? 1.5 million pounds of C&D waste that's accumulated in Nevada yearly. So we're only capturing maybe a tenth of that. So there's an opportunity for a lot more material recovery facilities to open up here in Las Vegas. And capture a lot of these recyclables. Once again, these recyclers will get the metal, the cardboard, the plastic that the MRF facilities are pulling out. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else? All right, seeing none, meeting adjourned.